Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for appearing today at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is October 1, 2020. We have three cases on the calendar this morning, and this is our second case. Again, please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. Announce yourself before you begin your argument so that we have that for the record. The marshal will show the running clock. You'll each have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Good morning. My name is Tim Johnson, and I represent Living Word Christian Center, the plaintiff and appellant in this case. And if it may please the court, the question before the court today is limited. It is a narrow question. It's a de novo review regarding whether, in light of the circumstances of this case, there was effective service of process in the underlying action. The case began and was commenced through Minnesota's substitute service statute, which is a statute that allows Minnesota statute 45.028, which allows plaintiffs to out-of-state defendants and specifically insurance companies via sending service, via certified mail, and then also to the Secretary of State. The complaint in this case arose from a failure to pay damages and an insurance claim. The damages arose from a June 11th, 2017 storm. And if you weren't aware, that's one of the most catastrophic events in Minnesota history. That storm decimated the entire North Metro, all the way from Blaine to Stillwater. So there were a lot of cases that on the deadline to file suit under the policy, which this one is 2 years. Virtually every property insurance policy in Minnesota is 2 years. So on June 11th, 2019, the parties had reached, or not yet reached, a resolution. I don't want to say they reached an impasse because they were still working together, but they hadn't reached a resolution.
Counsel, I think that we're all very well versed in the procedural history and the facts here. If you want to get straight to the legal issue that's before us, that would be helpful.
Sure. And the legal issue here is simply whether there was effective service. The facts of this case are actually really important.
Isn't the question a little bit different, though? Isn't the question not whether there was effective service? You serve something. The question is whether you serve the right thing, right?
Yeah. And maybe I'm using improper terminology saying effective service. Sure.
I mean, we're talking in very precise terms here, I think, because Rule 3.01 is of the Rules of Civil Procedure governs commencement of the action, of the action. Rule 3.01A says a civil action is commenced against each defendant when the summons is served upon that defendant, which is very specific, not a summons on any defendant, it's the summons, right?
Correct.
And you agree that that didn't happen here?
I do not. The Rule 3.01 states that you have to serve the summons. You're correct about that, but it doesn't prescribe a specific form. It says that the summons has to have the stated name of the court and the parties. The cover letter that was served to Church Mutual did have the correct parties. I will acknowledge to you the caption in the form summons that comes from the Minnesota State website had Liberty Mutual as a party, but the—
Well, counsel, are you saying that the cover letter and the summons are interchangeable?
I'm saying that there's no prescribed form for a summons. The requirements of a summons is not a single document. The requirer of the summons has certain specific statutory requirements, which are the stated name of the court and parties. It had that. It was signed by plaintiff's attorney.
But Rule 4.01 is titled summons form, right?
Correct.
So that prescribes what the form of the summons is.
Sure. And when I'm saying the form, I don't mean the substance of it. I mean, there's not a specific document that we have to use for a summons. The rule prescribes a certain number of requirements, stated name, signed by plaintiff, and a notice of default.
Well, there's more than that. The summons shall state the name of the court. You got that right.
Yep.
And the name of the parties. It doesn't have that, right?
Yes. But the forms that were sent to Church Mutual contained a cover letter. That cover letter contained the correct names. The caption on the document labeled summons had the wrong party's names. That is absolutely a fact. But I'm asking the court to consider whether the legislature intended for us to use a prescribed form and only one form, a template, or if you are to consider whether the requirements of the rule are met independent of any template form. I understand that the court has a template form. The question here, I think, is better posed is, did the opposing party have notice of claims against it? It did. The totality of the documents that they received, the cover letter, the summons, and the complaint, had every single requirement met to meet the requirements of a summons and complaint under the rules of civil procedure.
Is this an argument that the rules are somehow ambiguous?
I don't think that the rules are ambiguous, Your Honor. I think that the rules require a certain number of details, which we've just gone through. The documents that were sent by certified mail to Church Mutual met every single one of those requirements. Now, I will grant you that, I mean, the issue here is obvious. You don't have to be a detective. The wrong thing got stuffed in the wrong envelope. The question, I think, before the court is, as a matter of justice and equity, did Church Mutual receive sufficient notice that they were being sued in this action? The rules of civil procedure demand that we don't adhere to some technical formality in a template document. The rules are merely, did you have notice and were you aware? And this, Your Honors, I think is why the facts of this case are extremely important. And I don't want to bore you with a fact recitation. I want to give you the quick salient facts that show that they were on notice. And in fact, they were attempting to use the rules of civil procedure to dodge service entirely. So
Mr. Johnson, let me, the statute talks about process, and it requires you to send a copy of the process to the commissioner. So yes. what is the process as it's used in that statute? What constitutes process?
What constitutes process is mailing by certified mail.
What documents are the process?
The summons, complaints, and I don't know that it requires a cover letter, but in my experience, everybody does send a cover letter. So the commissioner knows what they're receiving. I don't think there's any question here that the commissioner received that. And that.
So you would agree. I mean, you just said the process includes the summons and the complaint. But you think does it include more than that? And if so, what's the legal authority for that?
No, I don't think it includes more than that. I think one of the questions we're wrestling with today, which I understand is a unique issue, is the summons just the form that says caption on it, summons, that most lawyers are familiar with? Or is a summons a series of documents or a collection of documents that meets the statutory requirements?
Did you mean to say summons or did you mean to say process? I'm just not sure what you meant to say.
Summons being a part of the process. Okay. So the reason I want to go over the facts in this case are because they're quite revealing as to what happened here. Again, I think the question before the court is, were they properly on notice of the claims against them such that a technical deficiency, which I'll acknowledge is here, doesn't defeat the court's jurisdiction, such as that this case can't get heard on its merits.
Counsel, I understand that's your argument, and you've referenced technical compliance twice, but the summons and complaint had a different property and a different insurance policy and different parties, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But it had. So arguably that's more than technical. You have a cover letter and then you have all this inaccurate information. And also I would point out, and you may want to address this, that given the chance to correct this, the email that was sent was all the wrong documents again.
What email are you referring to, Your Honor?
I'm referring to when in July 23rd, 2019, Church Mutual contacted Living Word, et cetera, saying that they'd gotten a packet of documents referencing all these things. And then Living Word then emailed Church Mutual copies of the same Lindsay Can-Am documents.
I can't even answer that. I wasn't aware that that email existed. My apologies. Obviously, that reveals the technical error of the mailing. We didn't have a chance to rectify it, though. They moved to dismiss it.
So. Oh, but to Judge Cleary's point, did you ever serve the correct summons and complaint on the defendant? And if so, did you do so within the 2-year limitations period?
No, I don't think so, because there was a motion to dismiss immediately. So if we could, I've got limited time here. I want to go over some detail.
Well, one more question, but sure. and did you seek to move to amend the process, and ask that it relate back to the original date?
No, we didn't, Your Honor, because the court was ruling on the procedural motion to dismiss. So no.
Okay. I mean, you rely a lot on Nelson and Tharp, and in both of those cases, I believe there was a motion to amend the process to correct the mistake. But you didn't take that step, so I'm not sure if you can take advantage of whatever benefits that case law might provide.
Yeah, Your Honor, and I think that given that the case was subject to dismissal, I suppose a motion to amend would have been possible, but the court was hearing whether the case should be dismissed at all. And the correct documents were eventually given to them after the record, I acknowledge Judge Cleary, the correct summons and complaint. The reason I think that this case is particularly troubling, again, factually, June 7th, the parties were close to a resolution, June 7th, 2019. They were not able to get on the same page. At this time, it was unknown to the church that the adjuster in that case agreed to extend the deadline for suit 30 days. So at that point, the statute of limitation would not have arisen until July 10th. On June 11th, the church hadn't been aware that this arrangement had been reached, so they did what they thought they ought to do and sued under the case. On June 14th, Church Mutual received that. It didn't contact counsel. Instead, it just allegedly forwarded those documents to Liberty Mutual, but it didn't contact the counsel where the letter came from. And this is important because on June 3rd, 2019, we are still under the extended deadline that was granted. The limitation period has not expired. Church Mutual received notice from the court that this case had been filed. The correct summons and complaint was filed. They did not contact counsel, even though counsel was noted on that notice of filing. On June 23rd.
And Mr. Johnson, does the defendant have an obligation to do that? Do you have any legal authority for that proposition?
I don't have any authority that the defendant has an obligation to do that.
To go search out the proper summons and complaint and to take possession of it through its own initiative.
No, I don't think that they have an obligation to do that other than a moral one, which I think was failed here. I don't know of any attorney that wouldn't contact another attorney if they received the wrong set of documents, and that's not on Mr. Prius. This was absolutely and obviously a waiting game for Church Mutual. They were working on the claim. They got notice that there was a lawsuit about a failure to pay a hail loss. They purposely did not contact plaintiff's counsel when they received those documents that they purposely...
Counsel, I understand the equities in the case, and I appreciate the circumstances that are troubling you. My question is what is the legal authority for the district court to even consider those circumstances under when this is a jurisdictional defect?
The authority is simply to determine whether or not... Really what we're asking here is whether the summons and complaint did they satisfy rules 3 and 4? And the question for that is set out in the statutory guidelines. It had the correct parties named, it had the correct county. The only question is whether they were on notice of the claims against them and whether they were prejudiced by any of the defenses that they would have lost by not being able to bring them. None of those things are present here. I mean, rule 1 is pretty clear. The rules are designed to affect justice. There's no justice here when the other side is on notice of these claims, specifically waits to dodge them until the extended limitation period has been expired. I promise that I don't think that the rules were ever designed to be a sword to cut off a plaintiff's rights for what is a technical deficiency. The requirements of a summons and complaint were met. I acknowledge those weren't met perfectly, but the documents that they received in a whole check every box requisite of a summons and complaint. Yes, there was a technical deficiency. It was a Scrivener's error. They knew it was a Scrivener's error. How else would they have known to contact us after the period expired? They would have had no other way if they didn't know who to contact. They used this as a procedural out They viewed it as an opportunity, and I don't believe the court should let them take advantage of it. Unless the court has any questions, we would respectfully request that it's reversed and remanded so the case can be heard on its merits.
All right, counsel, or any other questions from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Christian Preuss, and I represent the respondent Church Mutual Insurance Company. What this case presents is the issue of whether a simple cover letter can satisfy rules 301, 302, and 401, as well as the statutory requirements under 45.028, because all we have here really is a cover letter. And none of the rules require a cover letter. A cover letter can be a nice thing. It can be helpful, but it's not required. It's not subject to the rules. So the cover letter itself is simply not a document that is anticipated or required or involved in any of the rules or statutes at issue here. I'd like to pick up on one item also, and that is when looking, regarding one of the previous questions, when looking at Rule 301, it does use the definite article the when referring to the summons, and the definite article that when referring to the defendant. It doesn't use an or any or a, but it's not just Rule 301 that does that. Rule 302 does that. It refers to the complaint and the summons. Rule 401 uses the definite article the when referring to the summons, the parties, the plaintiff, and I believe four times when referring to the defendant, as well as the complaint. And Rule 45.028, subdivision 2, also repeatedly refers to the process, the defendant. The drafting of these rules is obviously done with great care, and using the definite article the is consistent with the general rule that there must be strict compliance when trying to effectuate service because it is necessary to trigger jurisdiction. So it's not a matter of justice and equity. It's not a matter of a technical formality. It's the basic requirements to trigger a lawsuit. And without those requirements, there is no lawsuit, there is no jurisdiction. The appellant has focused a lot on what the appellant claims is the factual background on what happened.
Mr. Preuss, before you go on, I wanted to ask a question about what you just said. Seems to me like the strict compliance principle that you rely on arises mostly from case law concerning service of process, not from case law concerning the process itself. In other words, a strict compliance is, I think, imposed upon the rules concerning the manner and the timing and the, you know, the person to whom something is delivered. But it seems to me there's a separate body of case law that has to do with the process itself, looking at the face of the document, whether the document on its face is valid or not. And Nelson and Tharp are of that variety. There's also a more recent Supreme Court opinion in DeCook. And those cases are a little bit more forgiving. They allow an opportunity for a party to move to amend. And they sometimes inquire into notice. Do you see that same distinction? I think you relied on, maybe you could explain why you relied on the cases that you did cite.
I think the Nelson case and the Tharp case they cite are significantly different. In Nelson, the court went through quite a detailed discussion of the corporate relationship between the originally named defendant in the case caption. The officers were the same of the two corporations. The corporations were related. And as you note, there was a motion to amend. The issue also was raised very late in the game. I believe just before trial. And when looking at all of those factors, including the fact that an officer of the correct defendant was served with the summons and complaint, that I think goes to your point that on those types of technicalities, it's more forgiving. Here, however, there's none of that. There's no relationship whatsoever between Lindsay Can-Am and Living Word. There's no relationship between Liberty Mutual and Church Mutual. They simply sent the wrong summons and complaint. And that simply doesn't get anywhere close to addressing the more technical defect of not naming the correct corporation when two corporations are affiliated. So there, I think it gets to the strict compliance of naming the defendant and the plaintiff. And they simply have gotten nowhere close to doing that here. I think they do concede they sent the wrong summons and complaint. So all they have is a cover letter. And a cover letter can be a helpful thing. And the cover letter here does reference Living Word, and it does reference Church Mutual. But the cover letter isn't a summons. And when you look at what's enclosed with the cover letter, realistically, at best, what you're going to recognize is this is confusing. Why does their cover letter enclose a summons and complaint in a lawsuit against Liberty Mutual? And why does it reference a cover letter to Liberty Mutual? This cover letter, and I'll concede cover letters, while they're not required, they can certainly be helpful, but this is not a helpful cover letter. This is a very confusing cover letter.
In your view, what is the meaning of the word process? In other words, what documents constitute process? What documents or documents, either singular or plural, constitute the process?
In 45.028, I think it's the summons and complaint. That the summons.
And why do you say both of those documents?
Because I think it's attempting to be consistent with the rules, which require both a summons and complaint. Rule 301 commences an action with a summons. Rule 302 requires a complaint to accompany the summons. So in the statutory process in serving an out-of-state corporation, and it's going to effectuate service, it's consistent with the rules to have that process include both the summons and complaint. It's also the common practice. That's how it just always happens. I've never seen it happen differently. I've probably seen it happen more than 100 times, and it's always the summons and complaint. So I think that's just well understood by everyone who goes through that process. With respect to the cover letter, a couple other observations that I think need some clarification. First, a cover letter like this, when it's received by whether it's Church Mutual or any other insurance company, if it encloses a summons and complaint with a caption on it that identifies the insurer in that caption or whether it's a corporation, anyone opening that knows what to do. We have a summons, we have a complaint, we have to do something. That's pretty basic. But when it encloses a summons and complaint against a completely different entity, there's nothing that puts that insurer on notice that it needs to do something with this. It received a cover letter that refers to a case title. Insurers and other corporations receive letters that refer to a case name all the time. In fact, there have been an open claim here for 2 years. It's not in the record here, but vast majority of times when you have claims like this, it will refer to the case name there in the correspondence. Doesn't mean there's a lawsuit. It means there's a claim open that's being handled.
Counsel, I think all of us are quite aware of the argument that you're making here and the rules and what did they say. Your opponent suggests a moral, equitable argument that perhaps it's a sharp practice for a firm to ignore actual notice and wait it out. There's no case law cited that I'm aware of. Your response.
You're correct. There's no case law. I've looked for that. I've seen no case law. And also, that's just simply not the situation here. The situation here is that this was a claim that was submitted. It was paid from Church Mutual standpoint in full. And then a couple days before the two-year period had expired, a public adjuster comes forward and says, oh, we have more damages. And will you give us time? And Church Mutual responds, sure, we'll give you 30 days. It's a relatively minor damage item. That 30-day offer by Church Mutual was never accepted. There's no response at all to Church Mutual's offer of giving 30 days. So the reality of the situation here is that there's no notice given to Church Mutual that Living Word is doing anything more because they never responded to anything. It receives a cover letter with some enclosures. And the reality of how that works is any insurance company has a mailroom, any office business has a mailroom. Someone opens it up and they have instructions on what to do with it. This isn't a situation where you give it to the claims handler and they're sitting there immediately putting together the puzzles here like a jigsaw puzzle and saying, aha, the plaintiff's attorney made a mistake here. Let's just sit and wait and do nothing. That's just not reality. And there's no evidence to that effect. That's not how it works. But even if it were, none of the rules transfer some type of responsibility to the potential defendant to do anything. It's the plaintiff that must comply with the rules, not the defendant that must step forward and help the plaintiff comply with the rules. So their characterization of the circumstances is simply not consistent with reality. There's nothing in the record to that effect. This is a situation where at the very last day, a whole bunch of these are probably going out in the mail in a lot of different directions, and someone makes a mistake and they put the wrong summons and complaint in an envelope. The result is Church Mutual has not received notice. They haven't been served. It's never corrected. The question is correct. When I first got involved, which is after the 30-day extension, if it had been accepted. And even then, the correct summons and complaint was never served. There's never any motion to correct anything, which could have been made, notwithstanding the motion to dismiss. That doesn't prevent the plaintiff still from coming forward and attempting to serve the correct summons and complaint. So the equities here, if the equities could trump the requirements of the rules, the equities simply aren't what the appellant is characterizing them to be here. Unless there are further questions from the court, that's all I wanted to say today.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Johnson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I completely disagree that the equities don't favor allowing a case to be heard on its merits. We got about a century plus of case law, all of which referring to the rules of civil procedure about cases being heard on its merits. That said, the question here, again, is really one of sufficiency of process. The strict requirements of 45028 were met. All of those things were mailed out. The question for the court today is, do plaintiffs have to use the prescribed summons form that most of the lawyers are familiar with, or is summons something different? Is a summons any series of documents which can put plaintiff fairly on notice that they have an action against them? The rule does not prescribe a form. The rule says a summons has to contain the name of the parties in the court that came on the cover letter. It says it has to be signed by plaintiff's attorney. It was. It has to provide the notice of default. They received that. That is a perfect summons, although imperfect in form, technically flawed, all of those things. It is a perfect summons under the rules of civil procedure if you consider everything that they received. As far as the complaint is concerned, the Supreme Court in Walsh said the only thing a complaint needs to do is state the pleader's theory and allow the defendant to determine whether a judge or jury must try the trial. This is also perfected. And granted, it was imperfect. It was not technically perfect the way you would want it. The question is whether did they, whether they had notice, and they did, and they purposely slept on it for the purpose of raising this argument instead of letting the case be heard on its merits. And that's what the court needs to focus on, is the fairness under the rules of civil procedure, where notice pleading state, and that happened here. And I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement. We will issue a written opinion in the 90-day deadline. Thank you very much. Stay safe, everyone. We'll stand in recess until our next case. Thank you.